listening to Dire Spork Music on Black Power 96. And we just finished paying tribute to Bonnie Pointer, who joined the Ancestors last week. And she was supposed to be on Dire Spork Music last week. And we have spoken to her older brother, Fitz, and we're in contact with Anita Pointer, and we have always been in contact with her partner, one of my, one of my cornflakes buddy, Lonnie Jackson. He was with Bonnie Pointer for many, 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 many years. And joining us on the line is Dr. Gerald Horn. Dr. Gerald Horn is the author of a brand new book, The Dawning of the Apocalypse, The Roots of Slavery, White Supremacy, Settler Colonialism, and Capitalism in the Long 16th Century. How did I do that? How did I sound doing that, my friend? Did I pass out? You're impressed? Clear. I want to take a class with you, so I guess you probably fail me.
No, I doubt it. Not after that rendition.
Well, how? I guess the first question I wanted to ask you is, how has the book been received? You think you're going to? You said you had got some reviews in some places that you had. A lot of your books have been getting reviews in places where you formerly didn't think you would come from. Am I correct in saying that?
Yeah, but this book is different. I mean, I think this book really unmasked capitalism and unmasked whiteness and white supremacy. And, so I'm not sure how it's going to be received broadly. But with most of my books, I'll say that the Black community in the United States will probably embrace it. And I would say that the international left overseas will embrace it. The question is the U.S. domestic left, which in many ways is still enmeshed in fantasies and fairy tales about the history and the reality of settler colonialism, which makes it very difficult for them to plan and plot against Trumpism, and actually leads them to naive evaluations with regard to Trumpism. Matter of fact, if you listen to some of these people on the left today, you would think Trump is on his way out. And of course, that's far from the truth. His base is not crumbling, but they don't want to deal with that because, as the line from the movie goes, they can't handle the truth.
Melinda, did you want to ask the first question?
Just to go on that note, I was wanting to know your impression of Trump's launch of his campaign. It was originally, rumored to be launched in Tulsa, Oklahoma, on Juneteenth. So I don't know if you wanted to talk about that.
Well, first of all, let me mention Juneteenth, because the next time we're on, it'll be after June 19th, 2020. So Juneteenth is now the day that is being marked in the United States as the formal end of enslavement of Africans. As the story goes, the Lincoln government general, Granger, showed up on Galveston Island. Galveston Island, of course, being the future home of Jack Johnson, heavyweight champion, and tells the enslaved, hey, you folks are free. The Civil War ended in early April, 1865. Now, let me make a couple points. Number one, I support the idea of having a day to mark the ending of enslavement of Africans, and June 19th, 1865 is as good as any. But the story, like many renditions of history, is rather mythological, almost farcical. The true story is that Texas, the most western state in the so-called Confederate States of America, was also the least damaged southern state during the U.S. Civil War. And the Euro Texans had an idea of continuing slavery even after the Confederate States of America had surrendered in April in Appomattox, Virginia, in 1865. Recall that as of 1865, Mexico was under the rule of a French puppet, Maximilian. Texas had seceded from Mexico in 1836 because Mexico had moved towards the abolition of slavery. With regard to Maximilian, the idea was that Texas would re-enter Mexico after the Confederate States had surrendered and either A, continue slavery, or B, have 99-year leases with regard to employment, quote, contracts, unquote, of Africans. But that plan was foiled, number one, because within 18 months of Juneteenth, the Mexicans had arisen and thrown out Maximilian, and they had done this in league with Black American soldiers who fought with them to expel the French, foil the plan to continue slavery. And by the way, George Washington Williams, who was an early Black historian, the Black historian John Hope Franklin wrote a book about him. He was amongst the Black Americans who helped to rout the French in Mexico. So that's the actual story. And if but for the pandemic, I would be writing that book as we speak.
I guess I wanted to ask you today, I think this is the 40th anniversary of the assassination of Walter Anthony Rodney. And I'd like to get your thoughts on, I think you met Walter Rodney. I know you, when he was assassinated, I know you went to Guyana, but I'd like to get your take on Dr. Walter Rodney. And he was a brother that I remember I had the pleasure of meeting him. And I also had the pleasure of meeting Maurice Bishop. And the thing that struck me about both of them is that every time you saw them, the first time I saw Walter Rodney, he gave me a copy of an editorial from The Nationalist, which was the newspaper of TANU, the Tanzanian National Union, I think. Julius Nyerere's the paper, well, that's when Nyerere was in power. He gave me this paper, and every time I saw him, he would always be giving you something. Like the first time I saw Maurice Bishop, he gave me the program for, the New Jew movement. But what are your thoughts on Walter Rodney?
Well, before I do, let me say that I hope Norman Richmond has arranged to deposit his archives at an appropriate university or library. Is that correct?
Yes, sir.
Oh, which one?
We're working on that.
I am torn between Gremlin or University of Toronto, but I don't know. I'm listening to people talk. I don't know if the universe. I would love to give this to the place of my birth, but I'm also torn because I've lived most of my life here. So what would be your suggestion?
I would say Toronto, number one, for the reason you just articulated, because you've been living in Toronto. Number two, it's sort of Toronto history, at least not all of it, but a lot of it. And so to take it out of that context, I don't think would be useful. Number three, a number of the folks who would like to examine that archive would be in Toronto or Ontario, and it would be easier for them to travel to Toronto. Now, my papers are in New York City precisely because I used to live in New York, and it's oftentimes easier for people to get to New York to get to other places. So that's
right.
My recommendation. But
right.
In any case, back to Walter Rodney. I went to Guyana. This was during another life as a lawyer, as a legal observer, because he and his comrades were on trial by the Forbes Burnham government. And I had just left Georgetown, Guyana, just before the tragic assassination of Walter Rodney. And I'm still impressed, and maybe you can answer this question, because one of the things that struck me about being in Guyana, the only English-speaking country in South America, a country of a population of probably less than 1 million, is the high level of intellectualism and the high level of political engagement and political acuity. I mean, when I think of Sister Ndaye and Clive Thomas, Rupert Rupnarine, Omawale, Chetty and Janet Jagan, et cetera, and it's difficult for me to speak about Walter Rodney and his high level of intellectualism and political engagement without thinking of the environment from which he emerged. Because usually when a person of that stellar nature arises, it's usually because he's arising in a context where there are other people like him. And I think that, and I'm still trying to figure out why Guyana has that high level of intellectual engagement. But in any case, you know,
well,
that Walter
think,
Rodney. Mm-hmm, go ahead.
I'm sorry. No, go ahead. I want to ask you a question, but you hadn't finished. Go ahead.
No, go ahead, please.
No, I met Guy when I first came here. I met Guyanese, and I was doing some research last night, and I found out that. Godfrey Cambridge, who was an actor, a great actor, he is Guyanese, was born in New York of Guyanese parents, but he went to Guyana, and he actually was educated in Sydney, Nova Scotia. And I don't know whether or not Godfrey Cambridge was he was definitely an egalitarian guy. I don't know whether or not I think he may have even been a Marxist, but I just found when I met the Guyanese, they had been socialists in 1953 before Cuba became a socialist country. In 1959, Guyana had a brief stint with socialism, and the CIA, of course, used the whole race question to divide. Chetty Jagan, UC Quiana, and Forbes Burnham, and you know, split that whole situation. But I found that the Guyanese were the most politically astute people that I had ever met. Because I remember Bobby Seale used to say when Huey confronted the police, the black people, you know, standing in the black community. Basically, was saying, you know, what kind of Negroes is these? And when I met these Guyanese, that was basically my impression. I was saying, like, what kind of Negroes is these? Because they were talking about trade unionism, international socialism, talking about Eastern Europe, China. And you know, coming out of California, I had a little bit of knowledge of that, but not in the depth that they had. No, I learned a lot from the Guyanese.
Well, just continuing about Walter Rodney, of course, he spent time in Tanzania, Jamaica. He's probably best known for the book Europe Underdeveloped Africa, although he wrote another sterling work on the enslavement and the slave trade on the Upper Guinea Coast of West Africa. And just to return to what Melinda was referencing, Mr. Trump will be launching his political rallies, his Make America Great rallies in Oklahoma, in Tulsa. Now, first he had scheduled it for Juneteenth, but he said, quote, his African-American friends, unquote, whoever they might be, had convinced him that he should move that date. So he moved it to June 20th, which is this coming Saturday. And Tulsa, Oklahoma, as you know, is marking the 99th anniversary, quote unquote, of the routing of the black community there, hundreds slaughtered, dumped in a mass grave because a young black man was accused of somehow offending a young Euro-American woman. And it's very interesting that Mr. Trump chose that date for the revival of his rallies. But one of the things I'd like to stress today is what I mentioned last week, which is the global protests in solidarity with Black Americans. We haven't seen anything like this perhaps since May 1963, when Birmingham, Alabama erupted at the same time that the organization then known as the Organization of African Unity was meeting in May 1963. And so in recent days, you've seen demonstrations at the U.S. Embassy in Pretoria, statements of solidarity by the ANC government in Pretoria, by the government in Accra, Ghana. You saw a lengthy letter in the Financial Times of London a few days ago from leading personalities from South Africa, Nigeria, Morocco, Ethiopia, and Kenya, perhaps the five leading African nations, all lambasting U.S. imperialism for its maltreatment and mistreatment of Black Americans. And also, you've seen parallel protests in New Zealand, Australia, Toronto, London, Germany, Paris. And it's quite remarkable. And let me also mention, I don't know if I told you about these interviews that I've done on Deutsche Welle, the German broadcaster. They're on my Facebook page, by the way, if you want to see them. But what was remarkable about these interviews with the Germans is that they were pressing me to acknowledge and concede that those defined as, quote, white, unquote, in the United States have a collective guilt, or should have a collective guilt, and should have a collective responsibility for what has befallen Black Americans and people of African descent, and Native Americans too. Now, this is a turnabout because, as you know, after Hitler was overthrown in 1945, the United States did not take the line that fascism was a product of big business in Germany and that there was a thriving anti-fascist movement that then led to the creation of the German Democratic Republic or East Germany. No, no, no. They said that all the German people were responsible, which, of course, elided pinning the responsibility on big business, which, of course, collaborated with Henry Ford, Charles Lindbergh, and other titans of U.S. society. And so now, with the downturn in Berlin-Washington relations, it seems that Berlin is trying to turn the tables and keep the pressure on U.S. imperialism. And one of the things that I have to say concerns me is that the community here, which sees reparations as a sacred cause, I don't really think they understand international politics. I don't think they have the slightest understanding, to put it mildly, of international politics. I don't think they keep up with international politics. We were talking about this last week. They see it as a waste of time. But I don't see how you can be, on the one hand, you know, you want to call all these Euros in North America devils. Okay, fine. But on the other hand, you don't want to follow international politics either. It seems like to me like you're just spinning your wheels, that you're not really serious. In any case, back to the issue, I think that Mr. Trump is feeling the heat, and that's one of the reasons why they're moving to impose sanctions on the International Criminal Court in The Hague, which has begun an investigation of U.S. imperialism because of its war crimes in Afghanistan. And of course, if there's any justice, the whole Trump team will wind up in orange jumpsuits in The Hague before the International Criminal Court, which is one of the reasons why he's putting so much pressure on the ICC as we speak. So the good news is that these protests globally are continuing. And I think that in some ways they represent a repudiation of Trumpism. It's a way for the international community to put a thumb in the eye of Trumpism. The bad news is already articulated, is the Trump base is not crumbling. Although you would think from talking to some folks that the United States is on the verge of a revolutionary situation, on the verge of a revolution, even though Trump's popularity ratings are still in the 40s amongst Euro-Americans, mostly, of course. And then they're mobilizing. You still have Black people being shot, just like in Atlanta, by the police just last night. You have these ultra-rightist groups who are buying guns and stockpiling guns like crazy. So I hope that we don't have to pay a heavy price for political naivete. And having said that, the X factor is, will these domestic protests continue? And I think that they will, And I think that they will, because now there's a new cause, which is defunding the police, as you probably heard, which in many ways involves either A, abolishing the police altogether, or B, just shrinking their budget, because the police, at least in the United States, and perhaps in Toronto too, most of what they do is rather mundane. It's like, you know, responding to noise complaints from officious neighbors. It's writing accident reports after an auto accident. It's dealing with the mentally challenged. And you don't really need a man or a woman with a gun to handle all of those issues. As a matter of fact, that's like throwing gasoline on the flames. You probably need a social worker. And in any case, because the police are like cowboys in blue uniforms, they're attracting lawsuits. And you have cities in the United States that have to borrow money to pay multi-million dollar judgments. Because, you know, you have lawyers. Some of them are friends of mine who made some fortunes. So in the police, that's what they do for a living. And many of them, I have to say, have gotten rich. Because, you know, it's not that difficult, as you may know, to get a multi-million dollar judgment against a police department. The lawyer takes away one third. And so, in any way, you would think that these people who don't like taxes, because you have to raise taxes to pay all these multi-million dollar judgments and to pay off these loans that you have to take out to pay these damage complaints. But that points to the other question, which I'm not sure is understood, which is that the police are not a thing in themselves. They basically represent the dominant culture and the dominant ethos. And part of the function and purpose of the police is basically to keep Black people in line, because Black people are seen as rebellious, seen as the disruptors of the status quo. And so folks, in some senses, are willing to pay the steep price, which is raising taxes and these multi-million dollar judgments against the police, just to keep that purpose, keeping the Black people in line, keep that intact.
Well, you know, these, I'm sorry, I cut you off.
No, go ahead.
The Black faces in high places, like in Toronto, Canada, there is, until recently, a Black chief of police. In the capital of Canada, we had a Black chief. We have a Black chief of police. And America, I don't know how many Black elected officials that we have. Do you think that Africans in America realize that, you know, just by changing we had Barack Hussein Obama for 8 years. Do you think that Africans in America and Latinos realize now that high faces in, or Black faces or brown faces in high places ain't necessarily the answer to our problem?
Well, I mean, I think it's a process. I mean, I think ultimately what people need to realize is that the Euro-American majority, by and large, is conservative, with a hardcore being reactionary. And therefore, just putting, as you put it, Black people in high places, on the one hand, it's a step forward away from conservative and reactionary politics. But on the other hand, it's clearly not enough. And so that's a very difficult tightrope for many to walk. And I think the major problem, as I see it, and, you know, there's an op-ed in the New York Times this morning, which basically denigrates and downgrades Black politicians, which I totally understand. But because the author does not acknowledge that prior point, which is that these Euro-Americans, they're just backwards. They're reactionary. And if you don't acknowledge that, it's difficult for people to move to this level that you're talking about, which is, you know, the Black faces in high places is not enough. And if we'll ever be able to move to that basic realization, I don't know why it hasn't happened yet. I mean, as I say every time there's a microphone before my face, in 1991, the Euro-American majority voted 55-45 to elect as governor the leader of the Nazi Party, David Duke, the leader of the Ku Klux Klan. I mean, what? I rest my case.
But I have one more question I definitely want to ask you. I should have asked you this earlier. You know, Kwame Ture, Stokely Carmichael said that every Negro is a potential black man. Jamil Alameen, H. Rap Brown said every Negro is a potential traitor. What do you think about this sister, Candace Owens? What are your thoughts on her?
Well, she's the Trumpian black woman commentator who was recently denounced by the comedian Dave Chappelle in his Netflix special. Of course, she deserves every attack that she receives. I mean, certainly, I mean, she's a lightweight, number one. And number two, has hardly any constituency amongst black people. On the other hand, I understand. You know, I just made the anecdote about David Duke. I mean, if you're a black person in the United States, and you're doing a political analysis, and if you're an opportunist, I understand why you say, you know what? I think fascism is coming to power. So let me get on the right side of the fascists. And perhaps that's part of the calculation of one Candace Owens.
Yeah, I tend to agree. We have a couple of minutes left. You have any question you want to ask Dr. Horn, Melinda?
Well, did you want to talk about your book?
Oh, yeah, yeah. The Dawning of the Apocalypse, The Roots of Slavery, White Supremacy, Settler Colonialism, and Capitalism in the Long 16th Century. Now, it's a long title about the long 16th century, but let me say that it's a deep dive into history, because just like if you walk into a movie three quarters of the way through, it's difficult to figure out the plot. And likewise, if you just begin to look at this phenomenon of capitalism, white supremacy, et cetera, and you're just beginning to try to understand it, or even understand it for the last 100 years, I'm not sure if you'll really get a grip. And so you really got to begin at 1492, which is what I do. And to make a long story short, the issue that I grapple with is how this minor kingdom on the outskirts of Europe, speaking of England, was able to surpass the Catholic power of Spain. England, of course, was Protestant. And the way they did that is, instead of Spain took religion much too seriously, you had to be a Catholic to be a settler. You could be a Negro and be a conqueror or conquistador as long as you were Catholic. Well, the Protestants, they moved away from that religious test towards pan-Europeanism, which morphed into whiteness, then white supremacy, and therefore their settlers could be Irish Catholics, who they'd been battling with. You could be Jewish. Of course, the English had expelled the Jewish population as early as 1291, but they made the historic compromise and accepted them as settlers. And then they made a compromise with the Muslims. One of the reasons there are so many Africans in the Americas now is because in 1591, the English armed the Moroccans to attack the Songhai Empire and defeated the Songhai Empire, a major political force, which then had knock-on effects throughout Africa, as far south as Nigeria, which softened up the continent for the African slave trade. So in a nutshell, that's that new book, and I recommend it to your attention.
Yes, I was talking to Walter Turner, and I think he said he's received a copy of it on PDF, you know, through electronically. But in terms of, have you done any interviews about the book yet?
Yeah, I've been doing so many interviews, I can't keep track. Let's see. Oh yeah, on Freedom Now. I mentioned on Freedom Now, KPFK. Yesterday, you can find it on Freedom Now, kpfk.org, yesterday at about, 11 a.m. Pacific. And, you know, I'm doing Walter Turner's show tomorrow. at 9 p.m. Central on kpfa.org. And, lots of interviews.
And I'm looking forward to getting a copy and we can kick it about that particular book. And you're through with the jazz, but the jazz book is how did it do in terms of sales and everything?
Oh, it's all good. You know, it got a lot of play. Been recommended by a number of experts, in fact.
Mm-hmm. Is there anything else you'd like to add?
No, I think we're over time, bro.
Oh, yeah, but we're not on commercial radio, so we are over time. So we can go a little bit over time, but you're right. We have to stick. We have to be disciplined. And thank you very much, and we will talk to you next week.
Good luck.
And I'd like, on behalf of Melinda Francis and Lisa Watson, until next week, we will see you in the whirlwind.